inside the prisons, and it's a clear indication, as we talked about earlier, about the lack of social distancing and the lack of adequate health care for incarcerated people. And I hope and pray that Lamia survives.
Sophia Elijah, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Executive Director of the Alliance of Families for Justice. That does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Mike Burke, and a fond farewell to Libby Rainey, our producer, who, well, we have traveled all over from the firefighting prison camps in Northern California to the border, to those long train rides between Washington, D.C. at the last minute in New York, and wherever a UN climate summit is in the world. Your compassion, your humor, and your intelligence will be missed. And fond farewell and best of luck in law school. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting
is... Have you gotten your flu shot? It's never too late to protect yourself, your family, and your community against the flu. This year, it is more important than ever. Black and African Americans, people of color, pregnant people, people without health insurance or a regular health care provider, people with pre-existing conditions like asthma, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, and people 65 and older are encouraged to get a flu shot. Multnomah County Health Department and Portland Community College are hosting a free weekly drive-through flu vaccine and COVID-19 testing clinic that will be held every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. until March 31st, 2021. At PCC's Cascade Campus, Parking Lot 1, located at 701 North Jessup Street in Portland. Entrance is on North Albina Street. You can drive through, bike through, or walk up to. To reserve an appointment for a flu shot or COVID test, call 503-988-8939. That's 503-988-8939. This campaign is a project of the Racial and Ethnic Approaches to Community Health and the Communicable Disease Services Programs. It is made possible with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Public Service Announcements.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, day three of the Derek Chauvin trial in Minnesota brought more eyewitnesses from the prosecution's side onto the stand who described their view of George Floyd's last moments. Among them was 19-year-old Christopher Martin, who worked at Cup Foods, the convenience store outside where Floyd was accosted by police. Martin, who was the one who called police after Floyd used a counterfeit bill, said he regretted it and told jurors, "I was standing there on the curb and I was just like, They're not going to help him. This is what we have to deal with. 45-year-old Christopher Belfry, who was a customer at Cub Foods, was also called in. The first witness of the day was Genevieve Hansen, a firefighter and emergency medical technician who had testified on Tuesday but was called back on Wednesday for a few minutes. Hansen had stumbled onto the scene of Floyd's arrest by accident while off duty. Her testimony on Tuesday was lengthy and compelling. Here is Hansen describing how she offered the officers help with treating Floyd.
In my memory, I offered to walk them through it or told them, if he doesn't have a pulse, you need to start compressions, and that wasn't done either.
When you couldn't do that, how did that make you feel?
Totally distressed.
Chauvin's attorneys attempted to paint Hansen as emotional, but her responses appeared to boost the prosecution instead.
Some people were swearing.
Absolutely.
And would you describe other people's demeanors as upset or angry?
I don't know if you've seen anybody be killed, but it's upsetting.
You called the officers a bitch, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I got quite angry after Mr. Floyd was loaded into the ambulance, and there was no point in trying to reason with them anymore because they had just killed somebody.
A stressful situation can impact your memory, right?
Absolutely. That's why we're lucky it was videotaped.
Right.
Later, the judge scolded Ms. Hansen, saying he would decide when her answer was complete and that she was not to argue with the lawyers.
I will determine when your answer is done.
Okay, well...
And so, do not argue with the court. Do not argue with counsel. Answer the questions. Do not volunteer information that is not requested.
Also testifying off-camera on Tuesday was Darnella Frazier, the teenager whose videotape of the entire incident helped the world see Chauvin with his knee on Floyd's neck as he died. Frazier, who was clearly traumatized at seeing a man who looked like her own family members die in front of her eyes, described the guilt that she lives with.
When I look at George Floyd, I look at my dad, I look at my brothers, I look at my cousins, my uncles, because they are all black. I have a black father, I have a black brother, I have black friends. And I look at that and I look at how that could have been one of them. It's been nights. I stayed up apologizing and apologizing to George Floyd for not doing more.
Frazier's 9-year-old cousin was with her when Floyd died and also testified on Tuesday.
I was sad and kind of mad because it felt like he was stopping his breathing and it's kind of like hurting him.
Meanwhile, Chauvin's defense team is attempting to portray the situation as one where police officers, including Chauvin, were distracted by the numerous witnesses who watched what was happening and who grew increasingly vocal as Floyd's life seeped out of him. But Frazier testified that Chauvin gave the crowd a, quote, cold and, quote, heartless stare as they yelled at him, and that, quote, he didn't care. It seemed as if he didn't care what we were saying. Outside the courtroom in Minneapolis, where the trial is taking place, the Washington Post describes how, quote, National Guard troops clad in desert camo and carrying assault rifles walk beside Humvees near the concrete barriers, fencing and razor wire separating the trial from the tribulations outside. Activists, members of Floyd's family, and journalists are thronging to express their frustrations and expectations of what is unfolding in the court. In other news, a New York man who was captured on camera brutalizing a 65-year-old Filipino-American woman while yelling racist slurs has been arrested. 38-year-old Brandon Elliott has been charged with felony assault as a hate crime. He had been convicted in 2002 of murdering his own mother with a kitchen knife to the heart and was on parole for life. President Joe Biden signed a memo authorizing an initiative aimed at tackling the anti-Asian hate crimes sweeping across the nation and has ordered the FBI to begin keeping track of incidents. A new study about healthcare in the United States conducted by West Health and Gallup has found that 35% of low-income Americans were unable to afford healthcare this past year, about 18% of the entire population of the United States, that's 46 million people, would not be able to afford care if they needed it now. There is a clear racial breakdown as the surveyors report how, quote, healthcare unaffordability runs considerably higher among Black adults at 29% and somewhat higher for Hispanic adults, 21%, than for white adults, 16%. In other healthcare news, the Trump administration's 11th-hour giveaway in January to the prescription drug industry is now facing criticism from Democrats who want to roll it back. The White House on Wednesday unveiled its $2 trillion infrastructure and climate plan called the American Jobs Plan, which aims to rebuild and upgrade failing infrastructure with an eye toward energy efficiency and job creation, and will tax wealthy corporations to pay for it. But a group of centrist Democrats, including Congressman Bill Pascrell, Tom Suozzi, Josh Gottheimer, say they won't back the bill unless Congress reinstates a state and local tax deduction that benefits wealthy residents in their states. In news from the pandemic, the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine appears to work very well in protecting children aged 12 to 15, according to preliminary results from clinical trials, and that they may be even more effective than in adults. According to the New York Times, the adolescents who received the vaccine produced nearly twice the level of antibodies on average compared with participants 16 to 25 years of age in an earlier trial of adults. The company has not yet released the data from the trial, but the press is reporting that of the 2,260 children who received the vaccine, none developed any infections, let alone hospitalizations or deaths. There were 18 cases of infection in a placebo group. Trump loyalist and Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz has been revealed to be the focus of a federal investigation that began under the Trump administration involving a sexual relationship with a minor. Because Gaetz may have paid for the teenager in question to travel across state lines, he may be facing federal charges of sex trafficking. The encounters allegedly took place about 2 years ago. Gaetz is denying the charges and claiming that he's the victim of, quote, organized criminal extortion. In an interview with Fox News' Tucker Carlson on Tuesday, Gaetz appeared to try to draw Carlson into the fray, reminding him of a dinner that they had had together. Carlson said this after the interview.
That was one of the weirdest interviews I've ever conducted.
The Washington Post reminded readers of Gaetz' close ties with another Florida GOP figure, Joel Greenberg, a former Seminole County tax collector who was arrested last year on federal charges of stalking and child sex trafficking. QAnon, the Trump-supporting conspiracy cult that is obsessed with wild theories of Democrats supposedly engaged in child sex trafficking, has been stymied by these stories of Republicans. And that does it for our news headlines. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Arkansas state senators on Monday passed a bill to ban access to gender-affirming care for transgender minors. Tennessee Governor Bill Lee recently signed a bill banning transgender kids from playing sports in schools. The Alabama legislature advanced a bill outlawing hormone treatments for transgender youth. These are just a few of the disturbing efforts by GOP-dominated state legislatures to target trans youth. In the past 3 months, there has been a record-breaking increase in such legislation, with more than 80 bills being introduced, the largest number of transphobic bills in the history of the nation. My guest is Jules Gill Peterson, associate professor at the University of Pittsburgh. She's the author of the award-winning book, Histories of the Transgender Child. Welcome to the program, Jules.
Thank you so much for having me on, Sonali.
So first, let's talk about the fact that the Republican Party appears to have picked this as the issue on which to fight their latest culture war. However, of course, it's been at least 4 years of pretty strong attacks against the transgender community under Trump. And even before that, of course, there's always been a struggle, not just for visibility, but for dignity, right? But it seems as though there's just this huge escalation very recently.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, in some ways, it couldn't come at a worse time. I think a lot of folks in the trans community are still reeling after the last 4 years. And in some ways, the Trump administration's anti-trans efforts, due to perhaps their sort of general political incompetency, you know, a lot of them didn't really end up making it into practice. And of course, there was an important Supreme Court decision last summer in which the court affirmed some of the employment rights of trans individuals. However, what we're seeing is, of course, on the state level, as is often the case, the GOP is much more successful at pursuing an anti-trans agenda or an extreme white-wing agenda than they ever are at the federal level. And so I think in some ways, you know, we're seeing the culmination of efforts that have been building for the last 4 or 5 years, certainly since North Carolina was the first state to pass its infamous bathroom bill, its anti-trans bathroom bill in 2016. You know, trans activists have been sounding the alarm ever since then, saying, you know, this is on its way, it's coming down the pipeline. We've actually seen a number of states, especially South Dakota, sort of serving as a laboratory, testing out bills that ultimately failed over the past few years. And then there was one in Idaho that was passed and now is tied up in court. And some of the right-wing groups involved in supporting that legislation in Idaho are actually the ones funding and circulating this sort of template bill that has sort of spread almost like wildfire across, you know, well over half the states now. So, you know, in some ways it hasn't taken trans people by surprise, but perhaps the intensity of it couldn't come at a worse time. And I think a lot of folks are waking up this week in the wake of some of these bills actually passing and wondering, oh my gosh, how did we get here? What can we do now? How can we actually protect the rights of trans children and protect trans people more generally? Because this is really somewhat of an unprecedented assault in terms of just the magnitude of the bills and the severity of what they propose to do in terms of criminalizing basic access to healthcare and also equal participation in education. So this really is, I think in some ways, a very dark moment, even if we sort of might point out that it seems that the GOP's strategy here is really to prepare for the 2022 midterms, to raise cash, and to sort of pass bills that they don't even expect to really make it into law. But even if it's sort of a cold political calculus on their end, the stakes are very high, particularly for youth. So it's a really troubling time.
So this is, as you said, is a common trend. This is the kind of thing that the Republican Party likes to do. The bathroom bills were a big one, but it's used this same strategy on things like abortion and gun rights, et cetera, or the right to just, you know, have access to as many guns as possible. So many different sort of cookie cutter bills that the Republican Party, because they have more success at controlling state legislatures or certainly hold state legislatures in a more stable way, they find a success at doing that. They often will purposefully pass bills in order to overturn legal precedents by pushing things all the way to the Supreme Court. So the bathroom access was a big part of it, but now they're taking aim at trans kids, especially transgender girls in sports. I mean, it just, and of course the bathroom bills were also aimed at kids in school, but the danger, as you said, of this cold calculus is that it fuels an existing, very life and death sort of transphobia that we have in this country, right? Kids get driven to suicide, bullying, and other hate crimes can be incredibly physically dangerous, right?
That's right. You know, it's the height of irony and hypocrisy, but it's a very cruel hypocrisy when we see, for example, the governor of Mississippi, upon signing an anti-trans sports bill, you know, proclaimed that he was proud to defend the rights of women and girls. And nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, how can one claim to be protecting girls and women by enacting legislation that specifically discriminates and targets vulnerable young girls and puts them in more dangerous situations? And one of the ways that I think these legislators are getting away with this is pretending that trans children are totally brand new, that they've never been in school before, we've never seen them go to the doctor before, right? And as a historian who spent extensive time researching the actual history of trans children, you know, nothing could be less true. Trans kids have been around as long as trans people have been around. They actually predate even the word transgender. They predate many of the medical interventions, you know, that some of these other bills are trying to enshrine and ban. But also, you know, I found evidence as far back as the 1930s of trans girls going to school as girls with the support of their family, their community, and their teachers, using the right restroom, participating in extracurricular activities. I mean, this is almost 90 years ago, right? So there's nothing new. Trans kids have been going to school for decades. They've been in our communities. They already are in our communities, but now they are walking around with a target painted on their back. Right. And I think one thing, you know, that's important to underline is they're sort of setting up this hypothetical scenario, right, that completely denies the reality of trans girlhood, because they won't even refer to trans girls as girls. Right. We've instead seen the popularization of this really incendiary language, calling girls biological males, mm-hmm. conjuring this fantasized male predator. And we're talking about young girls here. There's nothing biologically male about them. It doesn't even make any sense empirically. And no, you know, doctor would ever support that kind of language. But what it's really serving to do is take these girls out of the group who deserve protection and actually make them more dangerous. And we already know this because trans children face an incredible amount of bullying and peer violence at school. And when, you know, school administrators, it's not part of their job to protect those girls when they don't have the mandate to do that, then they're going to turn a blind eye to it. And we already know this because it's happened to so many trans adults. You know, I could share any number of stories of my experience in high school, which was very much like the way these bills want high school to be run, where it was impossible for me to get the support of teachers or adults to protect me from bullying, sexual harassment, sexual assault, and abuse, because it wasn't registered as mattering. I wasn't being counted as a girl. And so I think that's actually basically these bills want to push us back in time. They're setting up this idea that there's a hypothetical threat happening right now that doesn't actually exist, right? And when you talk to these legislators, as many journalists have done, reaching out to them, you know, they'll ask, okay, so you're proposing this bill to ban transgender participation in sports. How much of an issue is that in your state? And most of these lawmakers will admit they've never heard of any issue with transgender participation in sports in their state. And actually, they've never heard of any issue around trans healthcare in their state. And so they don't actually know any trans children. They've never spoken to any or their families. They're legislating completely without the benefit of any education here, and certainly none of the science, but also none of the statistics about violence against trans girls in particular. Young trans girls and trans women are extremely vulnerable to sexual harassment and sexual violence because it's not taken seriously.
Right.
And that to me is one of the most sort of cruel kinds of parts of these bills.
Right. If they wanted to actually address threats facing children, that is the place, the actual threats facing transgender youth. Let's talk about South Dakota, where you said these bills have been, you know, a test case in that state. They've been defeated. If South Dakota has been seen as a testing ground for the bills themselves, can it be a testing ground for defeating the bills at the state level? What did you learn? What can you tell us about what happened in South Dakota in particular? You know, what sort of opposition did those bills face? And can that be replicated?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, we were lucky to see it was sort of a strange way that the most recent bill in South Dakota was defeated, because the governor had sort of sent it back to the legislature and they didn't end up modifying the bill in time. So it sort of died procedurally, which is often the way that these bills end up being defeated, is procedurally. And, you know, South Dakota, you know, the reason why it's sort of been this laboratory for white extremist right-wing bills is that it's a pretty small state. You know, it has a small population, and so it's very sensitive to outside money. So conservative groups have been targeting the South Dakota legislature for many years with outside money in order to, you know, basically test run new kinds of legislation, you know, with the most minimum cost required and the lowest stakes possible before spreading that around the country to bigger, you know, more populated states. And so, you know, the interesting thing is, of course, they've been trying these bills for so many years, there's very organized opposition to them. But so far, it's very local opposition, right? Most of the people showing up to testify against these bills are trans youth and are the parents of trans youth. And as well, you have legal advocates, folks from the ACLU and other civil rights groups. But it's been a fairly narrow opposition in the sense that it's mostly been on the backs of the people most affected by these bills. And, you know, I got to give them credit. You know, these children and their families are incredibly brilliant, well-spoken, courageous, and resilient folks who are willing, you know, in some cases, year after year, to show up at the same hearings over and over again to defeat these bills over and over. I think one question we need to ask ourselves is, what kind of childhood is that? You know, if every year you have to go to the state legislator to beg lawmakers not to take away your life, your livelihood, and your civil rights. But I think it's tricky, and it's hard to put that much pressure just on trans children and their parents. Of course, it's understandable that parents are the ones to speak out. But I think if we want to think about the strategy for opposing these bills, we need a much broader coalition. I think actually the defense of trans children against these bills has been fairly weak. I think it's actually conceded a lot to the proponents of the bills. So for example, there was a viral video of a father in Missouri who was testifying against a bill there that the ACLU tweeted, and it kind of went viral on the internet. It was the must-see video that you had to watch to see this father's heartfelt testimony. But it was a really peculiar kind of testimony. You know, you have this very respectable father and business owner testifying to the lawmakers about how much he didn't like his own trans daughter and how hard he was on her, how much he harmed her for years and denied who she was, and only reluctantly, after a lot of years of hardship, came around to embracing her. And so that was his defense, was basically, I understand that you're transphobic too, but you have to respect the fact that I have the right to raise my daughter any way I want. And it's just sort of the weakest argument we could make. It concedes so much transphobia to the other side. And so I think one thing I would like to see is a broader coalition of folks who are invested in justice showing up and seeing this as their fight, right? If you are invested in abortion rights and reproductive rights, this is your fight. These bills are almost exactly the same as anti-abortion bills. They way overstep government authority. You know, Arkansas, only a few days before it passed its anti-trans healthcare bill, passed another anti-abortion bill that the governor signed. Of course, it's widely expected to be defeated in the courts, but there's a logic here. There's a kind of brutality and brutalization, and a hope that eventually it will make its way to the Supreme Court. So I think there's actually a broad coalition of people who might feel invested and want to show up and support trans youth, even if they don't have trans kids or know a lot of trans people or feel super comfortable with the ins and outs of trans identity. That's okay. You know, standing up for the dignity and personhood of children and their right, you know, to grow up safe and affirmed, I think is something we can all get behind. But more importantly too, there's a lot at stake here. You know, the folks who are on the same side of this debate as the Republican legislators include a wide swath of extremist groups, talking, you know, white nationalists, sort of anti-vaxxers, anti-maskers, anti-immigrant groups, and a lot of anti-trans feminist groups, you know, that are ostensibly progressive, but come down very hard and right-wing. And a lot of authoritarian political movements are using trans people as their scapegoat, right? And are suggesting that we need to punish and basically expel trans people from civil society and from public life in order to secure the nation, or to secure, in some cases, their sense of racial domination that they want to bring about in this country. So I think when we look at that broader coalition, we need to meet that challenge with a broad coalition of progressives who understand that, yeah, abortion rights, bills about guns and bills about voting rights are all interconnected in this legislative session. They all are sort of functioning on the same idea that it's okay for the government to take away the individual rights of whole groups of people in order to pursue more regressive authoritarian agendas and actually withdraw the public health from the responsibility of government, right? We're talking about government banning healthcare. Right? We're talking about government making it impossible to receive an equal public education. These are really core issues about the future of democracy in this country, especially after this now over a year-long pandemic where we've seen what happens when government fails to provide healthcare and fails to provide for the welfare of people. It hits marginalized communities harder. We've had over 500,000 deaths, and those have disproportionately fell on working class people, in communities of color, and healthcare workers, nurses, for example. And this is kind of the logic in which I want these bills to be seen. This is the context in which we're fighting and struggling right now. So I think in terms of how to, build on the success of South Dakota, I think we really need to broaden our coalition and see trans rights as integral to a broader agenda for democracy and justice and the public good in this country.
On Wednesday, March 31st, which is Trans Day of Visibility, Transgender Day of Visibility, President Joe Biden issued the first presidential proclamation. He also has appointed Rachel Levine, who became the first, assistant health secretary. She became the first transgender woman to hold a cabinet post in the country and, won Senate confirmation narrowly. How important is that visibility? And also, the second part of the question is, do you see the Equality Act, as it was just passed by the House, being able to address some of these issues from a federal level and kind of nip the state-by-state efforts in the bud?
Yeah, it's true that the Equality Act, if it were to be passed, and I have to say I'm very pessimistic about its chances in the Senate right now, if it were to be passed, it would be an immense help here because it would preempt, right, and overrule some of these state bills, which, I have to say, I think on their face, the state bills are so unconstitutional, it's unlikely they'll ever be enforced. But in any case, obviously, the Equality Act would be a great help. And I appreciate the Biden administration's attention. Certainly the confirmation of Dr. Levine from my home state of Pennsylvania is a really welcome one. And she's certainly a fierce advocate for trans children. I think part of the problem here is that visibility is actually also one of the causes of harm. It's trans people's hyper-cultural visibility over the past few years that has created this vulnerability where now we're witnessing such an intense backlash, right? And people are mistaking trans people's cultural visibility for the idea that actually maybe they didn't exist until now. And so it's okay to be so suspicious and punitive and hard on them, right? And so one of the things I'm a little alarmed by, I have to say, I appreciate the president's proclamation. I appreciate his verbal commitment to transgender inclusion and rights, but I would like to see a lot more leadership from Democrats on this issue. I noticed that there's a way in which a lot of Democrats are still very much invested in kind of representation or visibility politics,
right,
saying that we support trans people, saying that trans people exist, right? And those are nice words, but the specific motive of this bill in Arkansas is to ensure that trans people don't exist by preventing their development out of childhood. We are talking about an extremist set of measures here meant to erase a whole population of people. We need much more than visibility. It's not going to save us. In fact, ironically, in relation to the Trans Day of Visibility, many trans activists, particularly Black trans women and trans women of color like myself, have been pointing out for years that visibility actually endangers a lot of trans women of color. We become more hyper-visible, but not in a way that leads to our acceptance. We become the higher targets for forms of violence, while some narrow, acceptable, respectable versions of trans people are welcome and included in the media. So I really think Democrats need to think about how much is tied up in this moment, right? Saying that you support trans rights is excellent, but first of all, you need to step up and, make it clear that these state bills are unacceptable, they are unconstitutional, and that the federal administration will do whatever it can to to make sure that these don't end up becoming the law of the land. But I also think we need to hear from progressive groups and progressive leaders more robustly on what trans people need. We need civil rights, but we need so much more than that. The right to access healthcare is a very narrow right if not that many people get into those doctor's offices. And that's the case with trans children. Right? The amount of children who even have access to the kind of healthcare that's being banned is minuscule.
Right. Sports angle is one aspect of the bills, but the access to medical care and doctors is another aspect that is literally specifically being targeted, which is just unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. And, you know, I think we need to start calling out these bills for what they are. It's not an even debate. You know, the transphobic side has really a kind of stranglehold on most of the messaging here. See, really salacious, kind of sexualizing, sensational, moral panic language being invoked. And I don't really see Democratic groups and progressive groups really fighting back and calling that out for what it is and saying, this is a red line. We're not going to accept the eradication of trans people from this country. We're not going to accept them being completely dispossessed of their rights, but we're also going to advocate for the things that trans people need that a wide swath of working class people need. Free healthcare.
So just
right?
understanding that the rights of transgender people are very much in the middle of the spectrum, part of the spectrum of the rights that all Americans need, could use. Healthcare, such an important one, as you've said, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Jules, for joining us today. I know that you're a signatory to a letter that a number of educators will be releasing later this week, denouncing the slew of the record-breaking number of anti-trans bills that the GOP is advancing at the state level. And we'll post a link to that when we get access to it. Thank you so much and good luck to you.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Jules Gill Peterson, associate professor at the University of Pittsburgh. She's the author of the award-winning book, Histories of the Transgender Child. We've been discussing the record-breaking number of transphobic bills that GOP-led states have introduced in the first 3 months of this year alone. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As a new surge of COVID-19 infections emerges in the United States, the frantic race to vaccinate as many Americans as fast as possible is running into problems of more than just supply and distribution. Anti-vaccine misinformation continues to spread around the nation. And a new report from the Center for Countering Digital Hate, together with Anti-Vax Watch, has identified that a mere 12 people who are leading anti-vax advocates are responsible for the majority of disinformation. The report dubs them the Disinformation Dozen, and points out how many of them remain active on social media, spreading dangerous lies that are contributing to vaccine hesitancy. My guest is Imran Ahmed, CEO of the Center for Countering Digital Hate, and the report is again called the Disinformation Dozen, conducted in partnership with the Anti-Vax Watch. Welcome to the program, Imran.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
So where exactly are these 12 people? And we'll get into a little bit of who they are in just a moment. Where are they most active? I imagine that social media platforms is where you examined their reach.
Yeah, so these 12 individuals are really they're the front people for an industry, an anti-vaccine industry that has sown doubt among millions of people in order to make them distrust their doctors, the medical establishment, the CDC, and instead look to them for false cures for COVID, something which has driven a lot of anxiety, coronavirus, over the last year, and given them a fertile market of people searching for answers. But all they've got is false cures.
What are, let's talk about some of them. Joseph Merkel, whose name is actually quite synonymous for anybody who has studied vaccine hesitancy prior to the pandemic. He has been one of the leading, figures spreading a lot of disinformation about vaccines in general. How influential is he?
Well, Mr. Mercola is a well-established member of the anti-vaccine industry. The corporations he runs have dozens of employees. We know, for example, that they have millions of dollars of revenue and that they had the temerity during COVID to take out COVID relief loans from the government. So we've been able to map out these companies, try and understand them a little bit better. And what we find is that he has been absolutely crucial in putting together the propaganda, the misinformation that has led people to take decisions that put themselves, their families, and all the nation at risk.
One of the things, just to give our audience a sense of the disinformation that he spreads, you point out in your report that he had one post from the Merkel Institute saying the same number of people have died in 2020 that on average have died in previous years. This simply wouldn't be the case if we had a lethal pandemic. And of course, that's completely not true. Scientists have been able to show that there's a pretty stark difference between deaths, the total number of deaths on average from, say, 2019 to 2020. I mean, it's just pretty clearly out there a way to refute what he's claiming, right?
Well, I have no interest in disproving something put out by a professional misinformer, a liar, because they can ultimately flood the zone with nonsense. And it isn't our job, nor should it be the job of doctors who are working 14, 16 hours a day, psychologically under such stress, because of course they're coping with more death in this past year than they've experienced for decades before. And at the same time, they are being forced by virtue of this malignant disinformation industry that seeks again to economically profit from the disinformation that they spread. They are having to then go out and disprove the nonsense being produced. So you'll find it very rare that I ever actually say out loud any of the nonsense that they spread, because it is frankly just nonsense.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is another very prominent figure. He is head of this group called Children's Health Defense. He was banned from Instagram recently, and he too has a tremendous amount of influence. I understand that members of his own prominent Kennedy family have distanced themselves from him. Tell me a little bit about him.
Well, he's a member of the Kennedy family. He's been disowned by several members of his own family, and he wants to kill black people. So what he does is he puts out videos which tell African Americans that African blood is different to white blood and that black boys shouldn't be vaccinated. These are direct quotes of his. They are, of course, nonsense and lies, almost eugenicist in their design. And what they seek to do is persuade a community that has already suffered the brunt of coronavirus, the brunt of it, had the worst outcomes and have already suffered more death than any other community. He's seeking to compound the harm being done to that community by persuading them not to take the one thing that can, of course, protect people against coronavirus. So in that respect, he's, you know, the death that he's dealing is even more pernicious.
There are a number of others, about, of course, a total of 12, which is why they're called disinformation dozen. I understand that their disinformation ranges from all sorts of conspiracies surrounding the pandemic. You know, first of all, the issue of the pandemic itself being a hoax, and then, of course, the vaccines doing more harm than good, or in some cases them claiming that the vaccine is actually hurting people. What do they gain from this? You sort of alluded to it earlier by mentioning that they run these sort of lucrative industries. Is this a way for these figures to basically gain prominence by going against the grain, and maybe taking advantage of people's natural instinct for skepticism and fear, and thereby enriching themselves?
Well, I think you put it very, very pithily there. Look, this is an industry that's selling three messages, only three. It doesn't matter how garish or extreme the particular conspiracy theory or lie is, whether it's about people being lizards or it's about microchips in your vaccine. There are only about three things. One, that COVID isn't dangerous. Two, that vaccines are dangerous. And three, that you can't trust doctors. And all three of those are patently nonsense. But it's the third one that's key, because what they seek to do, like all groomers, and we are an organization that looks at counterterrorism, we look at child sexual exploitation, we look at a whole array of malignant actors who operate with free rein on social media platforms, which frankly are addicted to the profit that comes from the traffic generated by malignant content, that whatever the particular flavor of the extremists, they're always trying to distance people from trusted authorities. So they're trying to make you distrust doctors, people with actual experience and knowledge and understanding of medical conditions, so that they can replace them. Because they know that if they can become the source of information for people and persuade people to buy their remedies, they can make themselves very, very rich. And in many of these instances, we track the 501c3s, the LLCs, we look at the finances, their official filings, we look at other sources of information on how much money they're making. And believe me, these people are profiting handsomely from the misinformation and death that they spread.
And of course, it doesn't help that in posing themselves as critical of vaccines, they're able to take advantage of the skepticism that people have of big pharmaceutical companies, right? Because, I mean, for example, as a journalist, every time I cover anti-vaccine misinformation, or even for that matter, talk about the importance, the safety, the efficacy of vaccines, I'm dismissed by listeners who angrily email me calling me a shill for big pharma. And of course, the response then isn't to defend these pharmaceutical companies, because in many cases they do indefensible things, but making dangerous vaccines is not one of them, because the vaccines haven't been proven to not be dangerous. They've been proven to be very safe, very effective, but they seem to be taking, it's the sort of you're either with us or against us type attitude, it seems.